Arthrex has been helping surgeons treat their patients better for more than 40 years. Differentiate your practice by offering the Nano Experience, which combines patient comfort with leading-edge, extremely minimal invasive technology. Arthrex Nano Arthroscopy scopes and instrumentation are ideal for small joint access and visualization across the body. Deeply committed to surgeon support and patient education, Arthrex has also introduced the nanoexperience.com, patient resource illustrating the scientific benefits of nanoarthroscopy, detailing a wide variety of applications, and directing patients to surgeons in their area. Visit nano.arthrex.com to learn more about enhancing your practice and providing optimal patient outcome with this game-changing technology. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to yet another episode of the Nailed It Ortho Podcast. My name is Dr. Cole. Myself and Dr. Fitz start this podcast to go over high yield orthopedic surgery topics, and you are tuned in to yet another episode of the podcast. And this time we have a repeat guest. Yes, I did say that correctly. We do have a repeat guest. But today's topic, let me start off with that. First, we're going to be talking about posterior shoulder instability. I've seen a couple exam questions on this before, so it's something that you all need to know even if you're not going into sports. And we're going to go over everything about it. We're going to talk about some of the relevant anatomy. We're going to talk about history of physical exam and how to treat these patients that have these posterior that have posterior shoulder instability. And who we have coming to speak with us is none other than Dr. Amaya, who actually did our episode on anterior shoulder instability way back when. I think that's episode number 25, if you guys want to check that out. Crazy, we're 100, at least of these traditional type episodes. But he talks about anterior shoulder instability in the first episode, in episode number 25. And now he came back to talk to us a little bit more about posterior shoulder instability, a little bit about Dr. Mamaya. He did his medical school at Baylor College of Medicine in Houston, Texas. He did residency at University of Alabama at Birmingham, and he did his fellowship in sports medicine and shoulder reconstruction at the Stedman Hawkins Clinic of the Carolinas in Greenville, South Carolina. He does a lot of work with a lot of the sports teams at UAB. Real pleasure to speak to. This is a great episode, so stay tuned and check out the YouTube video if you want to check out some of the actual images and some of the visuals that go along to this audio podcast. Go on and check that out. With the link of that will be in the description, and enjoy the episode.
You are now listening to Nailed It, the Orthopedic Surgery Podcast, featuring Drs. Jay Fitz and Wendell Cole.
Welcome back to the Nailed It Ortho Podcast. So happy to have you.
I appreciate it. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. We don't have too many we have a couple of repeat guests, but not too many repeat guests. I think I can count on one hand the amount of repeat guests we've had. So just such an honor for you to take your time out of day and to come back and talk about the other side of the shoulder. The first time was anterior shoulder instability. This time we'll talk posterior shoulder instability.
Yeah, no, I love it. I always tell people, I wish this podcast existed when I was a resident. A lot of good educational material, great on-the-go material, and you guys do a good job of kind of covering the topic. So again, kudos to you guys.
Hey, well, thanks. Couldn't be here if it wasn't for you. But moving forward, we always ask a couple of questions just getting to know you. It's probably been maybe 2 to 3 years since we had you on the podcast. For those that are listening, go listen to our first episode on anterior shoulder instability, which was maybe at least 2 years ago. But since then, how's practice been? We got a lot of people that are starting off practice going into this, that are listening to this podcast or that are finishing up residency. Any tips or tricks or things that you've learned in the past couple of years, just as far as growing your practice and becoming more and more busy?
Yeah. I think practice has been going well for me. It's been busy, and on both the clinical front and the research front, we've been hitting it hard. Some advice I have for those coming out of residency, going into practice, coming out of fellowship and going into practice, is really just embrace that time to continue learning also. You know, a lot of people say, well, I'm done. I've arrived, and they feel like they're just ready to go. And I think the real learning starts when you start your own practice, right? Like, nothing is set up like it was in fellowship. You got to relearn a lot of things, get back to the lab, focus on some things that do by yourself. And then also just go out in the community and introduce yourself, physical therapy places, primary care places, to get some of that volume so you can develop and build the practice that you really want to and establish yourself in the community.
Yeah. I think all that's important, again, going in and meeting people. And then especially the part where you said about this is, that's when you start to learn, is when you is when you're on your own. That's the learning curve is real. Then even me and just my fellowship days here, it's still completely different than residency. And I know that starting off practice is going to be way different than fellowship. So looking forward to that. And number two, we know you do a lot of coverage for professional teams. And we have a lot of people that are listening to this trying to figure out where they want to go in their career. Some have chosen sports, but some are trying to choose whether or not they want to do professional teams or if they just want to just be the community person. I guess, what's your experience been like, I guess, coverage with the teams and what have you gotten out of it?
Yeah, it's a great experience, but it is tough. It's tough on your work-life balance. I'm married and I have two young kids. So I got to make sure I maintain that balance between seeing my family, being there for important events, and then fulfilling my duties as both a professional team surgeon and also a collegiate sports team surgeon. But it's honestly just a terrific experience. Also gives you access to pathology at a higher volume that you would otherwise maybe not see just being the community person. It helps you really establish your practice. I think accelerates the build of your practice much earlier because you can find that niche of what you want to do and hone in on that versus some people want to be the community person, and that's totally fine. And you'll probably be doing a little bit more general orthopedics, even though you're sports trained early on and you hone it down over the subsequent 10 years or so. But I think the coverage is good because it allows you to do a lot of things, meet a lot of people, and get the volume and the niche that you want to get.
Yeah, yeah. And that's some of the same things some of the docs that in my fellowship that covered the professional teams were talking about or saying as well. So great points that you just mentioned. And switching gears, now we're going to talk about the backside or the posterior part of the shoulder. With posterior shoulder instability, I guess, how often are people coming into your clinic with this? Like, how often are you seeing it? And then what are some of the causes that you've noted as to why people are having these issues?
Yeah, so posterior instability, in contrast to anterior instability, posterior instability or posterior labral pathology is not as common, or at least doesn't as commonly present. And really, an important kind of differentiating factor is when someone presents, if it's anterior instability, they usually come in and say, I dislocated my shoulder, or I feel like my shoulder is going to pop out, that type of stuff. But when people come in with posterior labral pathology, they usually come in more with kind of pain, right? They say, I got pain in the back of my shoulder. And what type of people that come in with these types of things? As we talked about, I take care of a lot of athletes. The most common person that comes into my clinic with posterior labral pathology that's symptomatic is honestly college football linemen. They put a lot of loads on their shoulder. When you engage at the line, you think about the position of your arm in a forward flex, slightly adducted, sometimes internally rotated position. This really puts a lot of load on that posterior labrum. So those are some of the most common people that present to my clinic. Probably next most common is weightlifters. Those who do heavy bench press really can get symptomatic if they have posterior labral pathology. And then the overhead athlete is actually a tricky one. We don't fully even understand it. It gets mixed up in the realm of other things like GERD and other things, and we don't always understand it. But those are some of the people that we see. Again, we talked about causes, really feeling a load on your shoulder. Sometimes I'll see people with either seizures or electrical shock. And the electrical shock is actually more often presents as a workers' comp injury with posterior dislocation. Those are pretty violent ones. And then seizures are, of course, very difficult to control. And those are quite violent mechanisms that honestly go beyond the traditional posterior labral pathology, can involve Bode stuff as well.
Yeah, yeah. I remember the first time I saw a locked posterior shoulder dislocation. I was actually in Colombia. I was in South America doing a rotation out there for a month. And the guy, I think, fell and his shoulder just hurt and just never went to the doc and came in one day. It was just locked. But like you said, very rare that you actually see these posterior shoulder dislocations leading to this kind of posterior instability. And just like you said, a lot of people that I've seen in my very short, limited experience of being like linemen or weightlifters or somebody that they came in complaining that they were having some shoulder pain doing a lot of push-ups. Now, I guess you mentioned the throwing athletes. What is, like, I guess the thought process behind how the throwing athletes get these injuries? We talked about the linemen where they're in their kind of their adducted forward flex position. What's the thought process behind this?
Yeah, with throwing athletes, it gets a little confusing, right? Because there's a lot of different pathologies that can occur. For example, in a baseball pitcher or overhead throwing athlete gets to the kind of the late talking phase and then has pain through that, including through the acceleration phase. You start to think about adaptive changes in the baseball player, right? These throwing shoulders, what's adaptive and what's become pathologic? And it's a fine line between the two, right? is that we think that there's somewhat of a peelback phenomenon sometimes of the posterior superior labrum. It kind of peels back and allows them to really get back there, right? Get that external rotation back. And so those can be somewhat asymptomatic. We know those studies that show MRIs on professional baseball athletes, there's a lot of asymptomatic posterior superior labral pathology present, a lot of slap pathology present. So it's tricky to figure out which ones of those are symptomatic and which ones are not symptomatic, which ones you have to address. And then, of course, the internal rotation deficit is when you have sometimes a contracture of your posterior capsule region. It's more commonly lower down in your posterior inferior glenohumeral ligament area. And we typically try to treat that still non-operatively with stretching modalities. But that's what some of the things we see. Often the contract can get confused with, are they having internal impingement also? Are they hitting is their supraspinatus getting pinched when they go back and their greater tuberosity hits the back of their labrum, that region? And do they have some internal impingement from that contact? It can be quite hard to decipher that. So again, very different type of scenarios when you're talking about the overhead athlete versus the classic question or board question. We're talking about a direct posterior labral pathology from loads.
Yeah. And luckily I haven't seen many questions about like the thrower's shoulder. It's been mostly like if they put something posterior, it's like a classic, just like you said, bench press or weightlifter or an offensive lineman with like the posterior labral tear.
Right.
Yeah. Right. That kind of classic question. And so you mentioned a little bit about, I guess you actually really mentioned most of the stuff on history. Anything that you think is important to ask these patients when you're talking to them? Like when they come to your clinic, they sit down with you, what is the information that you want to get out of them that you want to elicit within however many minutes you're getting the history?
Yeah, I think as we talked about, pain is one of the most commonly presenting symptoms. You can have some clicking and clopping also. But really what I like to ask them is, when does it hurt? Does it hurt when you're just sitting there? Usually not, right? They feel great. They feel fine sitting there. Does it hurt when you engage at the line? Does it hurt when you bench press? Yeah, that's when it lights up. And as soon as I'm done, take a day off, it feels great. I don't have any pain when I do this or this, but when I do these specific things, it hurts. So I think the history is extremely important when you're talking about this, because their arm position and where their location of their pain, posterior shoulder pain versus biceps pain versus elsewhere, that's extremely important. They really point you towards the diagnosis. Where orthopedic surgeons are quick to just jump to the imaging and figure that out. But this is one of those where if you listen to the patient, they tell you what the diagnosis is.
So you've gotten your history, 28-year-old professional lineman comes in, vague shoulder pain, especially after practices or after hard games. Next day is a little bit more painful. What are you doing on your physical exam? Like what maneuvers, what are you checking for? And then how are we doing whatever tests that we need to do to examine, to confirm our suspicion based on the history?
Right. So first, with any shoulder issue, I generally start with range of motion. Just check their overall range of motion, figure out what it is compared to their contralateral arm, check their rotator cuff strength. Still looking at posterior pathology, I go ahead and do my other tests too. I check anterior hypertension still, see if that gives them a little bit of a relocation test. In addition to that, checking O'Brien's for slap pathology and cross arm for AC joint, that kind of stuff. So you want to look through all those other pathologies, rule them out to a certain extent. And then, like you said, if I'm really assessing posterior pathology, labrum, my go-to test, honestly, is one that JT Tokish and fellowship actually emphasized and he taught me. It's the posterior push-pull test, right?
Yeah.
So you lay them on their back, get them just the glenohumeral joint hanging off the bed, and you grab their wrist, and then your other hand palm is right on their kind of basically humeral head, anterior humeral head region. And you're pulling the wrist while pushing the actual humeral head back. And someone like me who's 5'8", 140 pounds, former cross country runner, can still push a 300-pound lineman's shoulder out the back of their joint. And that's actually been the most important test for me, as a posterior push-pull test. I've really gotten and embraced that test, both in the clinic and on the operating table, and that helps a lot. Of course, there's a lot of other tests I can speak on. You got your load and shift tests, where you're compressing the actual humeral head into the glenoid cavity and assessing how many quadrants it may move back and forth. One of the more commonly tested things, the jerk test, right? The jerk test is where you can abduct and internally rotate and adduct the arm. And as you push that load on that arm, you're putting it in a provocative position. You're essentially pushing that arm out the back of the glenoid. So pushing the humeral head out the back, and it pushes it back. I think the most important part of this test, honestly, though, is where I bring their arm back into away from internal rotation and away from forward flexion and come back to extension. And that's really where people are like, oh, I don't know if it's doing anything. And then you bring it back and then you have the relocation part of it. I think that's the key part of the maneuver. Is that everyone's trying to feel and be like, well, is it out already? I don't know. I didn't feel the jerk quite. But I think the relocation maneuver is actually more impressive sometimes, is that you bring that elbow back posteriorly again and it like just goes back in, right? You take away that posterior directed force. So I think that's one of my important tests that I tell our residents. And then of course the Kim test, where you get up to 90 degrees of abduction, 45 forward flexion, I believe, and put a force posterior inferior through the humerus to see if they have pain with that. And again, that's somewhat similar to the posterior push-pull test in a way, but that's an important test also. Those are some of the most common tests, but the one that I've actually hung my hat on is that posterior push-pull test.
Yeah. And we may be getting into the weeds here a little bit, but when you're doing your range of motion test, are you having them lay back on a table and you're testing, you have their arm abducted and you're testing their external and internal rotation and comparing it to the other side? Or is it you're looking at them and you're having them forward flex the entire arm? Like, I know this is nitty gritty, but how are you doing actually your range of motion test? I know you mentioned GERD and a couple other things.
Yeah. It depends on what's going through my head. Usually if it's a football lineman, they're sitting up and I'll just look at it that way. But if it's an overhead athlete, then I think I really pay more attention to ruling out other pathology. I want to make sure they don't have a posterior capsule contracture. So I'll really get their scapula to stabilize on the bed, lay them flat, and then assess their internal external rotation. But you set the internal external rotation, you may do it, then your attending may do it, and another fellow may do it. And everyone's all over the place, right? Because when you do that rotation maneuver, one of the things I always tell my residents is, well, like you can internally rotate to someone till whenever, but you got to watch when that scapula starts to engage and lift back off the table. And then you're basically moving the entire kind of scapula, thoracic region a little bit. And then don't count that as true internal rotation, right? Once that scapula starts to engage and move a lot, you're past what their true range of motion is. So it's a difficult one.
Yeah, totally agree. And so just to summarize again, on your physical exam, you're doing a range of motion testing, you're testing for the cuff, you're doing it, especially your push-pull for your posterior labrum. That's one of the key things that you've done. Again, you have them supine, you're holding the wrist and you're pulling the wrist, but you're also pushing the humeral head posteriorly to see if it causes some symptoms or you may feel a click or something. And you also mentioned your other exams like the Jerk Kim's test. You also mentioned about your O'Brien's test a little bit earlier.
That's correct.
And so what imaging are you getting? Are you getting this x-rays when they come in, and then what's your threshold for more advanced imaging?
Yeah, so I think x-rays are important. On the x-ray, definitely getting an x-ray. Usually typically an AP and axillary are the two of the views that I care about the most. The axillary really tells me, it depends on what setting, right? If it's our resident seeing an emergency room console, we always got to rule out a posterior dislocation, right? One of the most commonly missed dislocations is a posterior dislocation. I think on every OID I've ever taken when I was a resident, there's a light bulb sign. Something looks off, you can see it, but you're like, is the ball out of the socket or not? And if you see that light bulb sign, be thinking posterior dislocation. So I think an axillary view is mandatory, honestly, in most shoulder injuries from an acute perspective. But in the clinic, I also get an axillary view. Some of the other things that can tell me also is the retroversion of the glenoid, right? Is if something is really pointed, the glenoid sloped in a way that lets the ball slide out the back of it, then they're probably higher risk for having posterior labral pathology. And perhaps, we still need more studies, but perhaps less likely to benefit from conservative treatment versus operative treatment, or at least have that discussion with the patient saying that you may not be able to overcome this with just conservative treatment. You asked me how quickly am I moving on to advanced imaging for posterior labral pathology. I'm pretty aggressive on moving on to advanced imaging. I think an MR arthrogram, it gives you a much better picture of that labral pathology. I was always told a crack in the back is always real. And so sometimes when you're looking at anterior labral pathology, you're like, is that a tear? Is that a foramen? Is that something going on? I've been reading these for years and years, and I still look at anterior labral pathology sometimes, and it's subtle sometimes, even though someone dislocated their shoulder. But on the posterior side, if you see that contrast, get into the junction between the labrum and the cartilage area, I'm pretty confident there's a labral tear there. It's pretty sensitive for that.
Yeah. And so what are you looking for on MRIs? Like, what are you, what views do you typically tend to look at the most for these? And then what are you looking for?
Yeah, my go-to views are the axial cuts. I think the axial cuts give you the best picture of what's going on that view. Again, looking for fluid, getting between the actual labrum and the glenoid is important. You can also measure your retroversion on the actual axial cuts on the glenoid. You want to look for any kind of reverse hill stacks, right? If you're talking about like a seizure patient or someone who's had more violent dislocation, a reverse hill stack essentially being an impaction fracture of the anterior humerus on the posterior glenoid. And that can, that can really be something important, especially if you want to address it surgically, perhaps with a subscapular adhesis into that defect to create it, to make it not engaging. That's important to know. So looking at that, reverse haggles and so forth, those are quite difficult to honestly appreciate. You know, and not common either. With a lot of these things are oftentimes, do they see us more than we see them, perhaps? But looking for any kind of bony component to your posterior tear, did a piece of bone break off? Do you have bone loss from chronic attrition of the posterior glenoid? I did that more in seizure patients where they've had multiple episodes of posterior dislocations and now you're losing bone on the backside of the glenoid and you're losing bone on the impaction fracture side. So that's what I look for. And the sagittal cuts, I also like the sagittal cuts when you're looking at this. Sagittal cuts, especially if you get the labrum in line, can give you a nice area to look at for detachments of the actual labrum. And again, measuring bone loss on a sagittal cut is nice also. Sometimes using similar principles as what we've done with anterior instability, looking at bone loss on a sagittal cut can sometimes be useful.
Right, like using that perfect circle. And I think you talked about it during our anterior shoulder instability talk, but using that the perfect circle when you're looking at the sagittals and measuring the glenoid and just using where it should be and then measuring the defect and getting that percentage wise.
Right, exactly, exactly.
Yeah, perfect. And so say, for example, again, we have our lineman comes in, they've been having this vague shoulder pain, you get an MRI, shows that there's like a posterior labral tear. How do you go about treatment? Do they go straight to the OR to fix it, or do we go non-op first? And if you do go non-op, what are we trying to accomplish with the non-op?
Yeah, so typically first line of treatment for posterior pathology, assuming it's just labral tear, no significant bone loss, mostly pain, not freak instability, it's typically conservative care. And conservative care, we're doing a few things. One, we're giving it time, right? We're giving it time to cool down, reduce the inflammation, reduce the pain from that. Number two, trying to really strengthen the rotator cuff. Your rotator cuff basically serves to compress the humeral head into the actual glenoid, right? And so strengthening your rotator cuff and other surrounding musculature can help with the stabilization of the shoulder and sometimes letting a labral tear, if it's more of an acute nature, scar down and heal down a little bit more. And then with a football lineman, though, depending on what level of athlete you're taking care of, it's interesting, right? If you're taking care of a football lineman mid-season and they have a posterior labral tear, I mean, in general, you're not taking them straight to surgery, right? Because the timing of the season, they're typically do tolerate some pain with that. You're able to play through it. Sometimes I'll do a PRP injection into the shoulder joint. Is that evidence-based? No, there's not a lot of evidence-based for that, but it is an anti-inflammatory effect to it without the deleterious effects of a steroid injection in the glenohumeral joint. So I typically will use that. Did you tolerate it? Did you like it? Was it miserable? And honestly, if the patient is continuing to have a lot of issues, whether they've subluxed, whether they had pain, like, this is constantly hurting me. I want to make sure I don't have as much pain with bench pressing in the off season and so forth. Then we typically fix these at the end of the season, especially in professional and collegiate level athletes. Because I think if you fix them, the outcomes are overall pretty predictable. That's one. Number two, they have a lower chance of recurrence of pain and symptoms the next season if you fix them. And so those are two reasons to go in and fix some of these that are going to remain active in contact sports especially.
Yeah. So say they failed conservative management, you've indicated them for surgery. What are you doing? How are you fixing it? We can just start with a simple labral tear and then we can go up the ladder with more like bone loss and then like a locked posterior dislocation. But how are you fixing these?
Yeah. So in terms of if standard posterior labral tear, I'll re-examine them under anesthesia on the table in their sleep. I like to do all my instability work in the lateral decubitus position. The reason I like that is a few different things. One, I think you can assess the labrum with a better view, honestly. The ability to do that is visualize the labrum and take care of all the pathology is better. And number two, you can also have a vector of pull of the humerus towards the ceiling in the OR room. So it gives you the ability to distract the humerus away a little bit better than beach chair, I believe, does. And then we'll make our standard posterior lateral portal, assess the joint, see what's going on. And then I'll typically, if there is a significant posterior lateral tear that we're going to repair, but what I typically do is I make an anterior portal in the anterior interval. And then I'll also make a ASP portal because I do like visualization through the ASP portal for my posterior lateral work. And now I'm sitting there with three portals, right? Got it. Viewing through my ASP, my posterior portal that I enter the joint with, and then my anterior portal that I can either shuttle stitches out of and do other work. But one of the things that I didn't really appreciate till I was a fellow is that the angle that you need to fix a posterior labrum many times is not off the posterior portal. Because if you try to drill and pass stitches, you could probably pass stitches fine. But if you try to drill and put your cannula through just the standard posterior portal, sometimes it'll work fine. But a lot of times what you see is that you'll be very horizontal on that glenoid. And if you're very horizontal on that glenoid, you're going to skive off that. So one thing I stress to our residents and other people I've worked with is not to get lazy. You always make more portals if you need to. So what we often do is an accessory portal off the posterior lateral acromion. And this is a PERC portal, so it's not as big as the other portals. You can use some percutaneous kits to go through this region, dilate up. And then through the PERC portal, you're actually able to pass using a lasso of some sort to pass the suture through the actual labrum. And then I typically do knotless anchors. And I really don't like tying in the shoulder. Few reasons. One, I don't want any kind of possible abrasion from the actual knots on the cartilage in the shoulder. I have taken patients back who got in surgery 10, 15 years ago who had knots and it was bothering them a lot from other surgeons. And I was like, well, let me take a look and see if that's abrasive. And I get in there and it surely is abrasive and I cut it out and they have immediate pain relief. It's crazy. Again, I think a lot of our mentors and surgeons have done plenty of knots stacks there that have worked well, but I think you got to be careful about cartilage abrasion. So I think we have technology nowadays to really make most of these repairs knotless. So again, that kind of second pearl there. Third thing is a lot of people think that it's just a pure labrum repair always, right? But your labrum and your posterior portion can get attenuated there. You get in there and it's not necessarily always massive bumper. You're like, oh yeah, it's detached. Let me just put this labrum right back on. So sometimes you do have to grab posterior capsule tissue with that labrum to tack it back on to give a more capsule labral repair rather than just a pure labrum repair. Sometimes they both go hand in hand and the capsule can get attenuated. So we'll often do that. I'll usually march my way up from posterior inferior to going posterior superior. And then if there is any propagation into a slap-like tear, I like to just keep my anchor on the posterior side of the biceps and not over-tighten that area. Because if you over-tighten that area, it can cause a lot of motion issues for a patient. And again, I strongly avoid putting any anchors anterior to the biceps for that reason too. But that's my kind of stepwise progression of going through the posterior labral pathology and marching my way up the glenoid. Again, you can do something through the posterior portal, but I highly advise people not to blink at all and just make an accessory portal if you need to. It's a game changer for you'll be happier with your actual vectors and angles of how you're putting in your actual sutures and anchors.
Yeah, that was great. Perfect. Great description. And just to recap, so you have your posterior portal, then you make an anterior portal, then you make an ASP or an anterior superior portal. You're viewing through your anterior superior portal, but then you mentioned our posterior portal. If you try to get an angle to put an anchor in from your posterior portal, you may not be able to do it because you're going to be skiving because you're more horizontal in regards to the glenoid. So you make an accessory portal, like right off the posterior lateral acromion, which you can use a percutaneous kit. And that'll give you a good angle to get down the glenoid and place an anchor and also pass some sutures. And then again, you mentioned you typically go knotless, starting lower down, posterior inferiorly, going out to posteriorly, superiorly. And one thing that you mentioned, grabbing some of the PIGHL, we're probably, again, getting into the weeds here because this is a sports scene coming out. Do the same thing for your throwers. Because I've heard some docs say they don't grab as much of the PIGHL if you're doing this for a thrower because you don't want to restrict their motion versus if it's just somebody who's frank instability, you want to get that more to tighten it up. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, good question. First of all, in my throwers, I don't want to do this operation at all, right? Right. You want to leave it alone. The return to throwing at a high level, it's tough if you're doing posterior lateral pathology. because a lot of times we don't know if this is adaptive stuff back there or what. Sometimes it's funny because sometimes we'll actually get in there, a thrower, and we'll release a contracture near the PIGHL, right? We'll release some of that tissue there. So in a thrower, I'm typically not putting an anchor down there and grabbing PIGHL. I'm actually usually in most of my throwers, the pathology seems to be more posterior superior in that area. And I'm usually limiting the number of anchors I'm putting in. I'm limiting the bites I'm grabbing. I'm not trying to grab this massive capsule bite with the labrum. I'm just trying to put that labrum right back onto the socket without grabbing a massive bite and being very judicious about what I'm repairing versus what I'm debriding.
Yeah, perfect. That was a great, great explanation. And I actually think this is a question on OIT. I think they showed a posterior, gave it the history, and then the answer was just to fix it. So arthroscopic posterior labrum repair. So for those that are doing this, that are doing questions, hopefully you get that question right. And so what about, when are we looking at bony procedures? Earlier, you mentioned some bone loss. You mentioned looking at our perfect circles. Or you mentioned doing a tenodesis of the subscap. When would you ever transfer the subscap or less tuberosity? Or what are you doing any bony procedures?
Yeah, those are tricky ones. The most common people that I'm doing any bony procedures on tend to be the seizure patients. Those are where we really see violent mechanisms over and over that have caused significant bone loss. If it's a reverse Hill-Sachs with posterior labral pathology, not significant bone loss, I have done just a tenodesis of the subscap only, right? Just put some anchors into the actual defect in the reverse Hill-Sachs, tenodesis the subscap. Again, it essentially acts like a tether, right? It's like a check rein. For it to dislocate posteriorly, you have to pull your entire subscap back. So that you can do that. When you have posterior glenoid bone loss, I've done things where we've used an allograft, right? Like such as a distal tibia allograft, and we've shuttled it in and fixed it with your choice of screws or some type of suspensory fixation with buttons. Those are difficult procedures. Those are humbling procedures, but sometimes the patient really needs it. One of the things I would recommend in that procedure is really spend a lot of time preparing your posterior bed to accept your bone block, because you'll be like, oh, there's a lot of bone loss. You have to get fly through it. And you're like, all right, I'm ready to shuttle in my graft. And then you bring in this graft and you're like, oh God, this thing's massive. How do I get this to fit and sit right? So I'd really recommend preparing the bed. You almost have to really debride it to a level of what you need to get your bone block in. Well, it's a little bit trickier than you would expect. One of the things that we don't see that very often done, but transferring your lesser tuberosity into the actual defect for someone who has a large reverse Hill-Sachs, and that's a bony procedure, obviously, right? You're doing to fill in that defect. That's an alternative, but you're also tethering your subscap that's on the lesser tuberosity down into that. So you have to remember the restrictions you may have with rotation with that. But we don't see that as often necessarily. Sometimes with like a locked posterior dislocation or something, you may have to do that and transfer it that way. That's really the only situation I'm ever taking an actual piece of bone off the lesser tuberosity and transferring it into the defect.
Yeah. I've only seen one, and that was the case when it was a locked posterior dislocation. And definitely those posterior bone blocks can be humbling when you get back there and you're trying to fix it. What about we talked about, those are a lot of different surgical procedures. We talked about history, physical exam findings. What's your typical ProSop protocol for these? How long, they always ask, how long am I going to be out? How long until I can get back on the field if it's playing some type of sport? What do you tell them and what's your protocol?
Yeah, so I typically keep them in a sling for about 5 to 6 weeks. I'd love for everyone to be in an ectal rotation sling, because there's some studies that show if you have them neglect that and they just go internal rotation and they adduct the arm, it could put a lot of force on your repair. I'd love everyone to be in an external rotation sling. Now, do they listen and wear an external rotation sling? It's just so hard to tolerate an external rotation sling.
Yeah.
I feel like a lot of the athletes I see, they just don't like wearing it. So then I'll compromise and just put them in our normal abduction smart sling type deal. And I'll make sure they say, hey, fist forward or slightly away from the body. But if they can tolerate that a little bit better than something that just keeps them in an external rotation thing. Now, if they have a significant posterior labral tear with maybe bone loss and so forth, maybe I'll be a little bit more aggressive and make sure I get them into a kind of either a gunslinger or a triangle wedge for that external rotation sling. So going through the protocol though, first few weeks, I keep them pretty quiet, just let things calm down, not do significant things, and then start the range of motion. Anytime you're looking at a PT protocol, the first thing you got to remember is that no one has the right answer for PT protocols. Everyone's all over the place. You ask one surgeon here, one surgeon there. PT protocols are all over the place. There's not a lot of good evidence-based medicine on why one works over the other and what we really need. Half of it's just honestly a time issue, I bet. But I think the most important thing when you're designing your PT protocol is knowing what to avoid. Like we talked about, internal rotation, adduction early on is to be avoided because you don't want to stress that repair. You just got to think of what to avoid and let them do other stuff. But range of motion in the first kind of 2 to 3 months. And then after that, after 3 to 4 months, start really building up strength in a gradual fashion. Of course, if it's your alignment, you don't want them to start doing heavy bench press too early. And then we think that labral repairs heal and they can get their strength back by around the 6 month mark. And so I typically allow them to be full contact, do everything they want at the 6 month mark, most typically for that. But it's variable. And honestly, our patients often push the envelope, and a lot of my patients go back a little bit earlier, despite kind of my cautioning to them of not messing anything up.
All right. The last thing you want is like post-op day two, they send you a picture of them bench pressing like, hey, doc, it looks great.
yeah, exactly. No, that's not ever good.
Oh, this is great. Again, this has been awesome having you back on the podcast. I think we talked about a lot regarding posterior shoulder instability. I don't know if there's anything else that you wanted to talk about or mention before we wrap this up for the people.
No, I think you did a great job of leading us through that discussion and covering the main salient points. The biggest thing I think for the younger residents is to really realize that anterior shoulder instability presents with instability. Posterior labral pathology presents with pain. And I know that dumps it down to just one big thing, but if it's for test questions or for clinical care in the office, I think if you remember that overall arching theme of how they present, it can like lead you down the right road.
Perfect. Well, Dr. Maya, again, thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast. Pleasure to have you back on. And until next time, those that are listening, feel free to leave us a review. Let us know how much you enjoyed this episode. And again, thank you so much for being a guest on the podcast.
I appreciate it. Thank you.
We've done it. We've done it. We've gone over anterior shoulder instability, now posterior shoulder instability. I guess next would be inferior shoulder instability. I've seen maybe one or two questions, not as high yield at all compared to anterior shoulder instability. But nonetheless, we hope that you enjoyed this episode featuring Dr. Momaya. Again, he came through and crushed it like he did the first time. We hope that you all enjoyed a bunch. We hope that you're subscribed to the channel. And without further ado, we'll see everybody next time.
Expand your diagnostic and treatment offerings with the Arthrex Nano Experience, which combines patient comfort with leading-edge, extremely minimally invasive technology for optimal patient outcomes. A pioneer in nanoarthroscopy, Arthrex has designed the next generation of needle scope visualization systems that incorporate high-quality, chip-on-tip image sensor technology to allow you to diagnose and treat a multitude of pathologies while providing your patient with a customizable treatment experience. Furthermore, Arthrex provides unparalleled surgeon support and resources, including the nanoexperience.com, a patient education website illustrating the features and benefits of nanoarthroscopy. Learn more about this revolutionary patient and surgeon experience and connect with an Arthrex technology consultant at nano.arthrex.com.